Thank you very much, Shane. Tonight on Arena, The Kingmaker, Citizen K, and Jumanji, The Next Level are the movies up for review, and we visit Googie's new exhibition at the Carolyn Gallery. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we'll start on this Thursday evening with our film reviews. The Kingmaker and Citizen K, two hard-hitting documentaries under the microscope. And the third instalment in the Jumanji franchise. This is called Jumanji, The Next Level. Arlene Hunt and Simon Marr have been to the cinema for us and they're with me in studio now. We'll start with the Kingmaker, Arlene. Imelda Marcos, 3,000 pairs of shoes. Let's get that out of the way very quickly because it's such a ha-ha, funny
yeah.
moment.
How relatable she is.
Yeah, exactly that. Well, that's about all I think you're going to laugh at in this movie. What story is Imelda Marcos or about Imelda Marcos are we being told here?
It's interesting because initially I wasn't sure where... it's Laura Greenfield as director here and I initially wasn't sure where she was going with this because she had... incredible access to Imelda Marcos, first of all, incredible access. These are one-on-one interviews. She's in Marcos's home, which is surrounded by great opulent wealth and full of, you know, servants. And obviously she's a woman of great means. And she's showing her all the photographs of her long, extensive career.
You know, for those who don't know the name Imelda Marcos, we should explain.
She was married to the 11th president of the Philippines, Ferdinand Marcos.
Who left in the left in disgrace in the 1980s.
They were basically exiled.
Yeah.
So she was a beauty queen and they like, she starts off with this sort of, you know, how she cries how the Philippines have fallen apart in later years and, you know, how poor it is now. And this is a very important line to remember this.
After the exile of her husband.
Yes, yeah, so she's driving through the streets and she's doling out cash to all the little kids, the street kids. And she goes to see, a cancer ward in this hospital and she's very upset over how, you know, poor the country is and how, you know, all the things that used to be beautiful are no longer beautiful. And when you're watching all of this, you kind of, in one hand, you're almost agreeing with her because things have obviously gone terribly wrong. But it's only later in the film when you realise that this particular narcissistic woman is part of a dynasty that has siphoned off, estimated about $10 billion from this country's resources, and that she and her children and her family and the dynamic of them are the reason why this country is as poor as it is.
It is in the state that it's in. Let's listen to her. I don't know if she realises even in this clip that the mask has already slipped. Let's listen to what she has to say about how difficult it was to get out of the Philippines back in the 1980s.
A few days before, there was a big reception that I had to wear some jewelry. Just as we were told to get into the helicopter, I saw a box of diapers for my grandchildren. So I put this jewelry in this box of diapers, diamonds in diapers. It saved us later on to pay the lawyers that cost millions.
The voice of Imelda Marcos there from the documentary The Kingmaker. Lauren Greenfield, obviously, Simon, won over the trust of Imelda Marcos and then just gave her the rope and off she went and she didn't need to do anything other than put the microphone and the camera in front of her and Imelda Marcos delivered.
And that's it. It seems like when you're watching it at the start and you're thinking, about the access and the access that comes through it all the way through and you think it must be ego. It has to be some sort. And you mentioned narcissism earlier a few minutes ago, but she opens up completely for all of this. And as you're watching the documentary, and probably for about the first 50 minutes as I was watching, I was thinking, why isn't she being challenged? You know, why is there nobody there as the foil?
You don't need to. She's going to hang herself
later on. But then you realise it would sound very strange. Mm. I mean, you would not get half the access that you had if there was ever a question asked or if there was a challenge made. Whereas if she just left there to go on, and you can see that she's utterly deluded and makes... no connection at all, even at this distance. And even with family still involved in politics, she makes no connection between her activities and the poverty that's going on outside.
But most disturbing, possibly, within this story that's been told, Arlene, and I can see you're almost holding yourself from roaring about this, Ferdinand Bong Bong Marcos Jr., who is the son, is the son of Ferdinand,
it's the son,
the original man, he is now running for election and she is right behind him.
She is. And
she's
so,
the kingmaker. She's he's the potential king. Yeah.
So he's going to run because... he is going to run to become vice president, because if he becomes vice president and then Duterte steps aside at some point, he will automatically go up into the position of president.
Duterte being the current,
yeah, the current president, who has a lot of issues of his own,
and very
well.
Much part of the populist movement.
Very much so. Very much so. He's a hardliner. He came down very hard on the reason he won is because he went very hard against the drug. There's a massive drug trade in the Philippines, and it's an open warfare for a lot of things. But this man is he has mobilized the police force into kind of his own personalized army, and no one can touch him, and no one can touch Imelda Marcos either. Like, she's, when she comes back from exile, this woman, like, she can generate so much press and so much devotion from the people who follow her, and they pass on to Bongbong.
Well, that kind of devotion that she seems to be able to achieve from those who are following her, to what extent, I mean, is she plausible? Because she puts across, as Arlene said earlier on, Simon, that this idea of being the kind of the mother, the caring mother, the maternal aspect of her. She's very worried about these poor people on the streets. How plausible is she when she says that? Or did you see right through it?
I think if you're at this distance away from the Philippines watching a documentary, it's very, very obvious, because even
it's easy to see through it when you're looking from far away.
Even from the very, very start, there's a beautiful aerial sequence kind of at the start of the documentary, which looks down a lot of the shanties around Manila, you know, and then by the time you come into Imelda Marcos, she's going around and she's pointing at various paintings, you know, and various things that she's got. So to us at this distance, it seems very, very clear. But to others, I think it's possibly one of those things that you look at the population of the Philippines, a lot of people who are utterly without hope. And they look and they
There's
find...
There's an actual scene in it where a woman living in a shanty house with no running water, no electricity, is talking about how she kind of reveres Imelda Marcos. Yeah. Because, and Imelda Marcos herself says at one point as well, people need to have beauty, so they need to look at beauty. And she said, well, she had this line, and I made a note of it because it really struck me, and it struck me all the way through. She said, perception is real and the truth is not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, it's the Philippines version of fake news.
Yeah.
And you know, and she carries this the whole way through.
Oh, she does. But, and you can tell too that she is utterly convinced by this. This isn't a put on that she's doing.
Yeah.
She completely believes this, and she completely believes that her son is the future of the Philippines, and the only way
legacy
that this
is
can
so
be
important to her. It's a legacy. It's for her, it's the family name, it's legacy, it's dynastic, you know, power of constant.
So ultimately, you know, what was the emotion coming out of this? Were you anger? Were you bemused?
I was horrified. I'll be honest. I was completely horrified. I was completely drawn and absorbed by it, but I was genuinely horrified. Horrified that she was able to do what she's able to do. Horrified that there's going to be a continuation of the Marcos line when highly corrupt and funded entirely by money off the back of all the poorest people in the region. Yeah.
And for you, Simon, it's something similar?
It's a pretty depressing story. That's the thing, as you watch it, like, you see, like, the poverty itself is depressing. The opulence that you see then makes it more depressing. But it's the fact that people without hope are really being cheated out of possibly having any hope in the future.
But I guess what's important to us in terms of a film review is how well does Lauren Greenfield tell the story? Stars from you, Simon.
I think she does this really, really well. I couldn't take my eyes off this story for a second. So this is a solid 4.
And what are you saying?
I give it 5 out of 5. It's hard to describe how this is a glimpse into a despotic sociopath. It's absolutely brilliant how she handled it, and how much rope she gave her. It was incredible.
All right. Citizen K is our second film. You obviously enjoyed the first documentary.
Yes.
An equally engrossing theme here. It comes from Irish filmmaker Alex Gibney. Russian oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky is the subject of this particular film, waging his own personal war against modern-day Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin. Let's hear Alex Gibney himself kind of set up the nature of this film.
To hear Vladimir Putin tell it, Mikhail Khodorkovsky is a villain in a real-life gangster movie. But to Putin's opponents, Khodorkovsky's 10 years in a Siberian prison made him a hero for the cause of human rights and democracy. Now out of prison, Khodorkovsky is looking for a third act. That drew my interest at a time when we all seem haunted by Russia's role in the world. So I started a film about him.
Okay, Mikhail, let me come.
Well, I could go to Russia, he could not. He's wanted there for murder. So like so many stories about Russia these days, this one started in London.
great dramatic music underneath there as well. Alex Gibney giving us the setup of Citizen Kane. The Citizen Kane question here, Arlene, is Mikhail Khodorkovsky.
Yeah.
So this is the third act that Alex Gibney is looking for, that the Khodorkovsky is looking for.
Yeah,
what happened in the first act and the second act? So the second act is in exile, which is where he is now in London. Yeah. First act is the important one, I guess.
Yes,
it
is. Enormously so. So the US, it's the late 80s, early 90s. The USSR is crumbling. They're losing or coming out of the communistic period and entering into a period of capitalism, which is completely... the Russians don't have any idea what capitalism is. It's not how they have ever operated. It's not how the Soviet Union was ever run.
Unless you're an oligarch.
Well, you see, oligarchs were created by the systemic movement from one thing to another because it opened up, it left a gap where all of a sudden Boris Yeltsin, who was the prime minister at the time, they ran into serious problems financially and they couldn't pay like your state wages. So the nurses weren't getting paid. The guys working in the oil fields weren't getting paid. The people that were like running schools, doctors, none of these people were getting paid. So these guys are able to come in and very, very quickly hand over fist, start making some serious cash and approach Boris Yeltsin almost directly and sort of say, well, look, we'll take over some of the burden that you're carrying, Mr. Yeltsin. From the bottom of their hearts. And so they snapped up all these state assets for really next to nothing. And they suddenly started making enormous sums of money. And that's how the oligarchs became from just being sort of ragtag businessmen to these monumentally wealthy men.
So what kind of businesses then did Khodorkovsky start off with in President Yeltsin's Russia?
His first business, and he said the one that made him his first million was a bank. He was essentially
a commercial bank.
So he looked after the bank. He then got involved in it. I'm going to call it a scheme. And a scheme where, I suppose, with reasonably good intent, they were giving people a chance to buy shares in the future of Russia. You know, but this was done by kind of like a voucher system. But because he had the bank...
Well, you were saying this with a lot of, it's also obvious, but, you know, people buy government bonds all the time.
Oh, yes.
That's what we're talking about,
but
really, isn't it?
I think the government bonds were designed originally to go to the people. You know, it's going to be that. But if he had snapped up a huge amount...
And he was paying people cash for these bonds. And he knew eventually, once he had enough bonds... that he would own state. He would have state control over certain things.
So he ended up as one of seven. There was just basically seven guys who ended up owning, owning Russia.
Yeah.
So he built these vast, vast, vast fortunes. And it's been described as the Wild West, is that everybody was there. There was a very short period of time when he got it. As same had happened in the Wild West, you got a small amount of people ended up owning everything. And he was one of the seven who owned everything. And even as he talks about it, he's utterly amoral in the way that he talks about it.
Right.
It's not like he made a sudden discovery and said, look, I was a bad guy, now I'm a good guy. He said, I was a bad guy, you know, but now it so happens that circumstances have changed.
All right, yeah, because I was going to ask, was there a blinding moment or a road to Damascus moment for him? Because the total change, though, in terms of, he's very telegenic and he's aware of that. And he cleaned himself up very nice. I think he lost loads of weight, did he?
He did, yeah. He lost weight. Yeah.
People compared him to kind of, you know, looks like a touch of Steve Jobs about him.
Yeah, for sure. And got his little steel
glasses. I just
mean
purely in terms of looks.
He's cleaned up very nicely. He got his little steel glasses. You know, he's very he's very engaging when he talks. He's always got this like little twinkly little smile, you know, going. And like he's quite affable actually when he talks to the
camera. So he's not apologising for what he's done.
No, not even a little bit.
When did he get the boot out of Russia? What did he do that annoyed President Putin so much?
Well, the first thing he did was challenge Putin, which is I think he underestimated Putin. That's actually what I think. And I think one of the things that was dropped in this documentary, which I would have liked to have known more about, is Putin's rise to power. Because Khodorkovsky rose to power because you see it in the thing.
Yeah.
But Putin came up from, he was a middle management kind of guy. And so I think the oligarchs underestimated him enormously because they had all this money. They were surrounded by yes men themselves. He at the time owned Yukos, which is the biggest Russian oil company.
Yeah.
There was no one to touch them.
Yeah, and Putin had come from the KGB.
He was KGB.
Should they not have been a little bit wary of that background?
But these guys are the kind of guys that would think nothing of murdering, say, a Lord Mayor in a town somewhere. Because he challenged them, because he had laid off loads of workers in the time of crisis and left the town to starve. And then when the Lord Mayor challenged him about it, the Lord Mayor wound up dead.
Right, yeah.
So these are the kind of men...
An accident type of thing.
So they didn't see Putin. Putin was like a shark coming through the water. They didn't see him coming until Putin was right there. And by the time Putin had gathered up enough power. Yeah. Putin that we see today didn't spring from the ground like a Cabbage Patch doll.
Yeah, but this Putin then, clearly Khodorkovsky was annoying him for Khodorkovsky to have to get out of the country.
Yeah, well, he ended up being sent to prison, I think a 10-year sentence for embezzlement and all sorts of things. And there's a great piece in the documentary where they talk about the court, and he said, well, it looks like a court and it seems like a court, but it's not a court. You know, so he ends up, he's sent away for 10 years. He then decides, I'm going to go into exile because he was worried for his life. At that stage, he had started really getting involved in the Open Russia movement. And this is where there's a real contrast in the movie, because while he's utterly unapologetic about all the other things he did while he's in Russia, he seems genuinely principled in his desires then to make Russia a better place.
Just have make Russia better.
To make, yeah, exactly. Make Russia great again.
Oh. High five, sorry. Yeah. But the thing about it is, he's a weird combination. He's amoral, as Simon says, but he's also weirdly brave. Like, he's genuinely brave. Like, if so, one of the guys, like, he was prepared to die in prison. He would go on hunger strikes, and what he would call an absolute hunger strike, would take no water whatsoever and no food to get what he wanted.
But isn't there also a kind of the other side? There's the very nice side of him, the Abramovich side, the guy who likes art, the guy who likes football, all this man of the people.
Yeah, of course. If you're that wealthy, you can easily put on whatever facade you want, really. Yeah. You just take it off your bespoke hangers.
So, do you think that Alex Gibney ultimately is presenting us the man with the facade, or is it a rounded portrait of Khodorkovsky?
I don't know. There's too many missing elements for me. I would really like to see that, like, what is the combination between him and Putin, because they were like two bulls in an arena going at each other, and you could see that, and he lost. He lost against Putin.
Khodorkovsky lost.
He lost. Yes, he was driven out of his own country.
He lost the first round, perhaps.
Oh, I think he lost it full stop, because what he doesn't seem to realise, which I thought was really interesting towards the end of the documentary, he's talking about how he needs to be back in Russia to effect change, and he really wants to go back and change things. But then they did a vox pop of people on the street in Russia, and people on the street in Russia like it the way it is, and they like Putin. They're proud of the fact that he is unbending and he's strong and he's this sort of domineering man. And it's interesting to me that for all of the knowledge that this man has in London and in exile and with everything, he doesn't know the people anymore. He doesn't seem to understand what they want.
Stars out of five.
Well, I gave it 4 out of 5. I thought it was really engrossing and really engaging.
And what are you saying overall, Simon?
I agree totally. I think 4 out of 5 is very good. I think it's the sort of film that, you know, as you watch it, or if you saw the trailer for it, you kind of think, this must be a drama. This is going to be one of those dramas where everybody smokes, wears fur coats and speaks in that accent.
Well, I mean, music.
But it's, everything about it, but it's a documentary you'll really want to see. So 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5 for me. But by the way, it's 126 minutes long. That's 2 hours. Does it hold for that?
It does, because it's broken up into segments, you know, where he gains his money, the Siberian prison is an experience, and then the sort of the third, you know, where he's trying to make change. Yeah.
All right, let's move on then to our third film, Jumanji. The Next Level.
Slightly different.
Yeah, this isn't quite in the documentary vein of the other two movies. What was the previous level? What do we need to know about Jumanji to get to the next level?
Well, so Jumanji was originally out in 1995 and Robin Williams was in it. And it's based on a series of books. But essentially what happens is real world people jump into a computer game. They take on various characters and they go on their quest or adventure or whatever it is. There was a spin-off to it in the early 2000s, but then it only really came back then with Dwayne Johnson and Jack Black and Karen Gillan and all those people became back involved then, 2017. It was huge. It was a massive movie, but I only watched it relatively recently and thought, okay, they've done what they can with this, but now
they've got to do more.
Yeah, but now they've come back and they've come up with something more.
I suppose we should explain that there are people in real life who then have avatars in the game. So can you explain the difference between the two? Because we're going to hear a lot of voices in the clip I'm about to play.
Each human character in real life must be represented by an avatar in the game. But they can be whoever they need to be. So it's Spencer
is this Alex Wolff's character.
Wolff, and his name is Spencer, and he goes into the game. In the original game, he was Smolder Bravestone.
It's Dwayne Johnson. So
yeah, Dwayne Johnson.
Alex Wolff becomes Dwayne
Johnson. No, in this one he doesn't. That's the weird thing. Okay. So he goes in and he's hoping to become Smaller Brainstone again. He's home, but it turns out he doesn't. He ends up being a completely different character. And everybody else gets sucked into the game. And they're all of a sudden the characters that they were in the previous film, which I didn't see, by the way, they're now different characters. But also, Danny Glover and Danny DeVito, who are in the house at the time when the game begins, they're also drawn back in and like put into avatars, and they're unwilling and unwitting, and they end up kind of in, and they're sort of, they're the kind of comic foil.
I think the basic premise for this clip that we need to know is people go into the game and they're surprised at the avatar they become when they get there.
Surprise!
That's what I think is going on.
Would you look at me? I haven't looked like this since...
Never. You look like this never.
I think my eyes are a different color.
All of you is a different color.
Check this out. Strengths and weaknesses. Linguistics.
Oh, goodness.
Nunchucks. That's new.
Damn, that's a good list. Weaknesses. Heat, sun, and sand. How is this guy a character in an adventure game? Man, it is hot out here.
I probably shouldn't ask you what's going on. What, is there a story here? Is there a plot line that will... No, there isn't. They go in, they become the Avatar characters... And what happens?
Well, they're going, like everything else, like every level, that's why it's the next level. So it's as if you're in a computer game and the quest is to do a thing. So the last time when they were just teenagers, you know, they had a quest that they had to go and do. In this one, they've got to go back in because Spence has already jumped back in. So they've gone back into this one. Let's call this level a rescue mission. But it's one of those things that
But while they're in there to do the rescue with Spencer, they also have to complete a mission because it's a video game. So they have to complete a mission. Yeah. So it's just Rory McCann from Game of Thrones is in it, and he is
he's the villain, is he? Yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely the villain. He's Yorgon the Brutal.
That's worth it.
It is. But
it's worth it for that.
But it's one of those things, you know, I think the thing, having seen and enjoyed the last, I'd say quite recently, they're bringing in the two old characters, bringing in Milo
Danny
and Eddie,
DeVito
Danny DeVito and
Danny
Glover, is a really good move because it's one of those things that, you know, when you're playing a computer game, whether you're picking up, you know, you're picking up extra, you know, power packs or whatever it is, there has to be a different thing. When it's an old codger, Danny DeVito playing an old codger, trying to pick up these power packs and do various quests, it does add something else to it. But the fact that he's doing all of that through the body of Dwayne Johnson, through the mouth of Dwayne Johnson, is I thought a really, really good stroke of
this. So it just sounds like a bit of fun. Is it mindless Christmas fun? You know, should you go?
The kids are going to love it, I think, because there's some really great clips in it, you know, where they're going across rope bridges with these absolutely terrifying mandrill monkeys chasing them, and that's actually quite good. And Jorgen the Brutal is quite good. Okay. I just think children will enjoy it because it's that kind of ludicrous, high spirited, it's, you know, it's probably a great Christmas movie, you know, and I think kids will just go along and they'll have a hoot and the parents will
have a snooze because it's Christmas
time. Have a gin and tonic before you go in and it'll be fine.
So is Jorgen the Brutal, is he a guideline as to the nature of this movie, or is it much funnier than all of that?
No, it does have its moments of fun, and it's one of those films that if it took itself too seriously, or as even as the series took itself too seriously, it would be so utterly
nonsensical.
There's
a horse in it called Cyclone who's also Bethany.
But I thoroughly enjoyed it. This child here thoroughly enjoyed it. You know,
so you enjoyed it. It's just fun, but don't get wrapped up in what's going on.
And I don't think anybody would think about a film like this too much. So 3.5 stars.
3.5. Yes. Okay. Jorgen the Brutal was your greatest moment.
Oh yeah, I'm going to give it 3 out of 5 because I try to think of it like what would kids like, and I think kids would get such a kick out of like the ostriches and the terrifying monkeys and stuff. So yeah, 3 out of 5.
And 3 out of 5. All right. That's Jumanji. The Next Level, The Kingmaker and Citizen Kane, the other two rather different movies that we were speaking about this evening with Arlene Hunt and Simon Marr. Googie, a founding member of the Virgin Prunes and friend and muse to U2, has been a practicing artist since the early days of punk rock in Dublin in the 1980s. He now has a very successful life as an artist. This year alone, he's had a solo exhibitions in the Arcane Gallery in LA, the Yoshi Gallery in Tokyo, and tonight, Googie's exhibition Broken opens at the Carlin Gallery in Dublin. The new paintings are certainly more abstract than past work, which involved depictions of household objects such as bowls and jugs, with numbers and text incorporated into the colourscape of the paintings. And in a more recent development, Googie has begun to create sculpture. And in the centre of the Carlin Gallery, as part of this current exhibition, are three large imposing black bowls cast in bronze with a luminous golden core. Along the walls are acrylic paintings on brown paper in perspex frames. Keshihi joined Googie to talk about the work in the gallery, and they began at the bowls.
So as we come up the stairs, you see the paintings, obviously, but then you see three cylinders, or three very solid sculptural bowls. What size are these?
These are approximately a metre in height by just over 1.2 metres across the widest part of the mouth. I guess this is the shape that I started with, and it, you know, takes me right back to my roots of these perfect lines and this bulbous thing. And these particular bronzes, there's three in this series, it's really dealing with, I suppose, two sides of a coin, or the inside and the outside of something or someone, whereby I've gone with this, they're not varnished. I've gone with this really dead, soft black. There's no reflection in it. There's no shine to be seen. And it's just dead. And as you can see, the inside is very highly polished, like the back of a wedding ring. And it's just dealing with life and death, just those two opposites, the vibrance, you know, and the beautiful light reflection of the inside and the total deadness of the outside.
And when did you get the idea to go sculptural?
John Rocha, many years ago, said to me, I'm doing this lifestyle centre. He was doing the interior design for a lifestyle centre up in Beacon Court, up in Sandyford. And he said, I want you to do the art for the inside of the main building. I just thought to myself, brilliant, I've got a great idea for a series of paintings. This is what I'm going to do. And then he interrupted to say, but it must be sculpture. And right before he said it to me, I had done a show with the Tony Schifrazzi Gallery, the Schifrazzi Gallery in New York. It's over 20 years ago. Tony Schifrazzi said to me, if you made sculpture, it would be a wonderful introduction to your paintings and people would understand them more. I started making sculpture. I came, and strangely enough, it felt like the same thing to me. I think a painter can make sculpture, while a sculptor can't necessarily paint. And it just feels the same, because the mould that's used in the kiln to make these shapes come from drawings. Drawings are what I've done since childhood. So for me, it was exactly the same thing. I make the drawings, I get the line. You've got to visualise it to an extent. And what I'm trying to do is for the size that the bronze is, the bowl or the pot, just always looking for that perfect shape. It's how I started out in childhood, fascinated by, I would set up little still life compositions. I would work for hours and hours and hours on them.
I was reading one of the catalogues, and I think it was an essay by Sean Scully, and he said, making similarities between himself and you, he said that you'd both worked from hurt into art. What did he mean by that in relation to you?
Well, I remember in that essay, you know, he referred to the way some people will latch onto playing the blame game, or other people will go out and change the direction of their life. I think that's what he was referring to. I was one of 10 children. We grew up in Cedarwood Road in Ballymun, old Ballymun. I had an extremely strict disciplinarian dad. You know, he was a wonderful guy too. He did have a bad temper. He was Jekyll and Hyde. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Actually, you know, two sides of a coin. These bronzes, just looking at the sculpture now, he comes to mind.
You were obviously painting or drawing all your life. What sent you in that direction? Was there some inspiration that sent you there?
Yeah, I think the punk movement, you know, that started, I mean, that was really about two fingers up to pretty much everything that is boring or everything that I didn't like. The Virgin Prunes started at, I was the only one that had a car. So back in the old days, I would very often drive U2 around, the drum kit strapped to the top, guitars in the back. I'd often do a couple of runs to get the guitars there, to get the equipment there, then get the band there. And they were practicing in a little house that they had rented as a rehearsal studio out in Malahide. we were a tight bunch of friends and we hung out all the time. So we were just hanging out, drinking tea while they were rehearsing. And they stopped to have their cup of tea and their sandwich. And Dick picked up Edge's guitar. Dick, being Edge's older brother, was our guitar player. My brother, Strongman, picked up the bass and we started. And we says, come on, guys, we can do this. Let's make a band. Punk had started happening in London. It was just like freedom. I'm not a musician. I found myself and Gav were the two front men in the Virgin Prunes.
That's Gavin Friday.
That's Gavin Friday. The Virgin Prunes was a tangent of my painting because, as I say, I was never a musician, even though I love music very much. What I brought to the Virgin Prunes was very much a visual thing, and that was a tangent of being a painter. I was interested in costume, performance, makeup. I saw the music that the Virgin Prunes made as a soundtrack to a performance. But I also did wall drawings, I did record sleeves, I never really left painting when I was in the Virgin Prunes. But then in 1984, parted company because I was just being sucked into what I already was and I just had to give all my time to this. And I've never looked back.
And who were the artists then, Googie? Who were the people around town? Was it people like Mick Mulcahy?
Exactly right. Would have been one of the first names that I'd have mentioned. I remember Phelim Egan, who's also, I would say, a friend of mine. I love Phelim's work. Nigel Rolfe, you know, was very much an inspiration to the Virgin Prunes because myself and Gav, as teenagers, wandered into the Project Arts Centre and we saw him performing. And we just says, this is unbelievable. There is no limit to what we can do. We're going to do exactly what we want. And that's what we did. You know, the Virgin Prunes, we aimed so high that 9 times out of 10, we probably missed the target. But anybody that was there when we happened to hit the target, I don't think has ever forgotten it, you know.
You wanted to talk about this work, which is not called Broken.
It's called Barbuda. If you go right back through my work, you know, I've always used turquoise. It can be a greeny turquoise, a blue turquoise, a grey-green, grey-blue. And I was out in Barbuda earlier in the year, the island of Barbuda, out in the Caribbean. You know, you see these colours. I've seen them on postcards and calendars and books, you know, on documentaries, where you see these beautiful turquoise and you can get a beautiful light turquoise bar in the ocean as you look at it from the distance, covered with a more grey colour each side. And they deeply affect me, you know, these turquoise colours. There's little bits, you know, of weed in the ocean. Sometimes you get the ripple of a fish. And the way a memory is almost like a dream, it's the memory you want to capture. And, of course, a memory, in a visual sense, becomes very abstract.
Do you think there are ghosts in the work? Do I see faces in some of the paintings?
Well, you know, I can't argue against my subconscious. I sometimes see things that I didn't realise were there. It's not that they're not there, but I don't purposely do any particular shape. I just instinctively move my arm and move my hand the way I feel it needs to be. Of course, I see things in my own paintings that I never saw before. Like shapes, I mean, as you say, you know, you saw what looks like it could be a face, you know, a ghostly figure. I also spot things that I didn't realise I put in. But as I say, it's purely instinctive when I'm painting. And as time goes on, more and more it's the way I paint.
Is it a big breakaway, breakthrough for you to be so abstract?
No, I think, well, for instance, when I was in school, I was fascinated by traditional still life drawing. The way the light hits an object, if it's a bulbous, you know, shaped object, the way it you know, it captures the light, it can throw the light, and then the shade comes into play. And as a general rule, most of the great abstract painters were fine draftsmen. And that is something that I came through as a child. It's something that I did all through so much of my spare time sitting around the house, drawing on the back of boxes, drawing on the back of sheets of paper. And it's a natural progression. I think, you know, as time goes on, when you're painting all the time, you just feel less and less of a need to put in the lines and the strokes, getting away from that photo realism. Actually, the very start of this series, the entire line of the ball was in, which I showed at the end of last year in Château-Lacoste. And I just found, as the series developed, you know, I guess the latest painting one does, they have more knowledge. That can be a good thing or a bad thing. Searching, you know, for the perfect painting always, one I don't think ever hits it. But it's in that search. It's really in the unknown. Like, I think most of my best work was actually an accident.
Featuring her signature themes of identity, eroticism and existential quest, the stories in Sarah Hall's third collection, Sudden Traveller, bring the reader to several very different locations, from Turkish forests and coastlines to the rain-drenched villages of Cumbria. Yvonne Nolan has read Sudden Traveller and she's with me in studio now. Sarah Hall, tell me a little bit about her and her previous work, the nature of the writer here, Yvonne.
I suppose you summed it up a little bit there in the intro. What she's really well known for is her ability to write about otherworldly worldly situations while keeping it somehow rooted in the real. So her last collection of stories, Madame Zero, which won several prizes, and one particular story in it
won a very important...
Mrs. Fox won a very important prize. And in that story, you know, a quite uptight businesswoman becomes a vixen one day when out walking with her husband. And it's so improbable. You don't see it coming because she writes the reality so nicely that you're not expecting the unreality when it comes.
So it's in some ways, we're in a realistic world. We're in real places and we're in, you know, very, for the most part, contemporary situations.
Yes.
But into that, she pulls a kind of a mythical quality and a quality of fable.
Yes, you can really see the influence of myth and fable in her work, even when she's just describing how women think or how they think about their lives or how they think about, maybe there's a woman thinking about her mother dying in the same year as she has her first child. And there's a kind of obsession in Sarah Hall's work with really ancient stuff. And I suppose, you know, fairy tales and myths were the first stories we told ourselves. So they're really, really important. They go to something really deep. And she recognises that and really capitalises on that in very modern contemporary work.
All right, well, let's say the very first story in the book, I suppose you couldn't get a more modern or contemporary tale and theme than is in this particular story. M is the simple title.
Yes, and I'm assuming that M is the name of the character. Very few of her central characters are given names. But it's the story of a woman who is a very successful lawyer. She has a nice life, but like Mrs. Fox, she's reached the limits of the possible in her life. She has a handsome young lover who's also a brilliant architect. On paper, she looks great. But the thing is that she handles a legal case for a woman's shelter called The Haven. And how Hall describes this is that she's biding.
Biding.
So what she's actually doing is, I think what a lot of lawyers find themselves doing sometimes when a case is lost before it's even begun, is that she's shoveling paperwork because the place where the shelter is has been bought by the second richest man in the country. There's nothing going to stop office blocks going where the women's shelter is.
So she kind of, if you like, transforms herself then from this lawyer representing them into something else.
It's very reminiscent of the transformation in in Kafka, although it's more richly told because it happens. Well, it seems to me to happen over a longer period of time. And so the other parallel thing, and it answers other themes in the book as well, is that, and it's something I often find myself thinking about at my age, is I've got this far in life. I survived the accident on holiday. I survived the car accident. I came out of that dreadful illness. And you get to a certain stage in your life and you're beginning to think, I might be running out of chances. My nine lives, you know, mightn't be so great anymore. I might be through eight of them. So she's thinking that anyway. And then she begins to get pains at around 3 o'clock in the morning, terrible stomach cramps. And of course, Hall is so acute in her observations. For between 3 and 5 is the time of the day when most people who are ill die. It's that hour when people steal away. And so all this is conflated in her head. But then she transforms. And I don't really want to give too much away here because it is really beautiful.
Yeah.
The surprise again, just like in Mrs. Fox, what happens here and how this woman kind of turns into an equaliser in a real way for the women who seek shelter at the Haven.
Right, so it becomes something very different and moves away from the realism.
Yeah, and other things interest Hall, like beyond, you know, we could look at the popularity of vampire tales in our contemporary times and so on. And here we have a woman who, to all intents and purposes, has superpowers, is supernatural. But what fascinates Hall in the end is that her character, while doing some amazing things with her supernatural strengths, does the most amazing thing of all for a woman, is she doesn't ignore herself. She doesn't put herself aside. And that's the most radical thing a woman with superpowers could do.
Yeah. There are two stories. Death is an important theme, but there are two stories where death is very much to the fore. A story called Orton, which is a town in Cumbria.
Yes,
I think.
Yes.
And also then the title story of the collection, Sudden Traveller.
Yeah, and I've mentioned that briefly, Sudden Traveller. So the three stories you mentioned, so that first one, Orton, and Sudden Traveller seem to be the very heart and soul of this book. So those three stories, for me, are what it's really all about. And if there were just those three stories between the two covers, I'd be so happy because they are three wonderful stories. So in Orton, a woman is travelling from somewhere in the south of England back north to where she's from, to Cumbria. She's going to this little village called Orton, but it's not because she was born there. It's because it was the middle village between two other villages, one village she came from and a boy that she had one date with once comes from the other village. They agree to meet in Orton, they go for a walk on the moors and they have sex on the moors. And the thing about it is, alone in this woman's whole previous life and definitely from the older age when she's looking back at this stage, nowhere has she been so free of fear. So she wants to go back to the place where she was free of fear, because that few minutes of union with that boy on the moor was the most perfect moment of lack of fear she'd ever experienced. Why does she want to go back to where she had no fear? Because she's in heart failure. She's had a radical device put in her heart that keeps it going. I'm not sure it's a pacemaker. It's bigger than that. Because we're in the future, because her cardiologist says to her, you know, there's a code you can get. You ring a call centre, give them this code, give them your passwords and they will give you a code and you have a little remote control. You press your remote control and your heart gives up working. And the character says to her cardiologist, well, you know, she was a bit, you know, of course, frightened. And she says, what will it be like? And the cardiologist said, well, I think it would be, you know, strong and beautiful. I think it'll be a sort of climax. And with that, the character begins to realise at that stage, the reason she has to go back to this place where she had this date with the boy is because you literally can't control anything. The more than she couldn't control that moment of that day where she had sex with that boy. She can't control death either.
Yeah.
And that the thing that circumscribes so many lives is fear and the attempt to organise life when life isn't organisable. And the thing is, she describes that moment of sex on the moor as the slaughterhouse of desire. and you go from the Slaughterhouse of Desire to the Slaughterhouse of Death
itself.
Yeah,
it was death.
It's beautiful. It's so beautifully imagined.
And I know in the title story as well, we're dealing with, I think that's the story where you mentioned about the daughter and the mother's dying just as the daughter is giving birth to her child.
So, let
me just ask, so clearly in those stories that we've spoken about there, we're talking about female protagonists and female stories.
Yeah.
Are they all, do all the stories have that, or just predominantly?
There's one story where the central character is male.
Is this the grotesques?
This is the woman the book read. The woman the book read, which is about a man who could have had a relationship with a daughter. So, in fact, the magnetic character at
the
heart
daughter.
Is a woman called Ara, who could have been this man's daughter, who is in a way his spiritual daughter, but he's left it too late to do anything about it. And so it's quite sad.
Let me just read a couple of sentences here from the opening story that we've spoken about. A warm, damp, starless night in the city, the last night of summer. Darkness moves like an ocean above the roofs and starlights and streetlights. The wind is directionless, confusing the trees, and so it continues down to the last line in the paragraph. It is the hour between prayers. I mean, this is incredible. Just on a word-to-word, line-to-line basis, it's incredible writing.
I mean, she's a wonderful writer, not just because of her rich word store, but also because of how richly she imagines everything and then how beautifully paced her writing is. So that sentence on sentence, not alone are the words right and beautiful and the insights are original, but also there's pace. There's a beautiful poetic pace.
A touch of Dylan Thomas even in that opening.
Every sentence has balance. Every paragraph has counterbalance. I mean, you don't really find writing like this in our times, because I think partly why we don't see it so often is because a lot of creative writing programmes teach a spare style. They tell you to pull back. There's a suspicion of too many words where one will do. But she uses words so beautifully, and she taxes the reader. Sometimes she'll use words that aren't English. Sometimes she'll use words that are in Greek script. So you have to go to Google Translate to try and figure out what the hell that meant. And I love that about her, that she'll give you no help.
Yeah, but having said that, you know, the spare style or the sparse style being very much in vogue, this is a very short book with very short stories within it. So it's economic for all its nature.
Yes, when you really think about stories, what you notice is the amount of time that's given in description compared to like the overall story arc of every story.
You enjoyed this collection.
Oh, I loved it. I mean, just the pictures, it's for a writer, it's by a writer who really loves language, for a reader who really loves that very old-fashioned thing of language, words beautifully used and put together. A very old-fashioned but still a wonderful thing when you read it.
Big recommendation there from Yvonne Nolan for Sudden Traveller, new collection of short stories by Sarah Hall. It's published by Faber and Faber. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy.